find them. Nearly everywhere, Agassiz encountered an unyielding reluctance to accept his theories. Humboldt urged him to return to his area of real expertise, fossil fish, and give up this mad obsession with ice. But Agassiz was a man possessed by an idea. Agassiz's theory found even less support in Britain, where most naturalists had never seen a glacier and often couldn't grasp the crushing forces that ice in bulk exerts. "Could scratches and polish just be due to ice?" asked Roderick Murchison in a mocking tone at one meeting, evidently imagining the rocks as covered in a kind of light and glassy rime. To his dying day, he expressed the frankest incredulity of those ice-mad geologists who believed that glaciers could account for so much. William Hopkins, a Cambridge professor and leading member of the Geological Society, endorsed this view, arguing that the notion that ice could transport boulders presented such obvious mechanical absurdities as to make it unworthy of the Society's attention. Undaunted, Agassiz travelled tirelessly to promote his theory. In 1840, he read a paper to a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in Glasgow, at which he was openly criticised by the great Charles Lyell. The following year, the Geological Society of Edinburgh passed a resolution conceding that there might be some general merit in the theory, but that certainly none of it applied to Scotland. Lyell did eventually come round. His moment of epiphany came when he realized that a moraine, or line of rocks, near his family estate in Scotland, which he had passed hundreds of times, could only be understood if one accepted that a glacier had dropped them there. But having become converted, Lyell then lost his nerve and backed off from public support of the Ice Age idea. It was a frustrating time for Agassiz. His marriage was breaking up. Schimper was hotly accusing him of the theft of his ideas, Charpentier wouldn't speak to him, and the greatest living geologist offered support of only the most tepid and vacillating kind. In 1846, Agassiz travelled to America to give a series of lectures, and there at last found the esteem he craved. Harvard gave him a professorship and built him a first-rate museum, the Museum of Comparative Zoology. Doubtless it helped that he had settled in New England, where the long winters encouraged a certain sympathy for the idea of interminable periods of cold. It also helped that 6 years after his arrival, the first scientific expedition to Greenland reported that nearly the whole of that semi-continent was covered in an ice sheet, just like the ancient one imagined in Agassiz's theory. At long last, his ideas began to find a real following. The one central defect of Agassiz's theory was that his ice ages had no cause, but assistance was about to come from an unlikely quarter. In the 1860s, journals and other learned publications in Britain began to receive papers on hydrostatics, electricity, and other scientific subjects from a James Croll of Anderson's University in Glasgow. One of the papers on how variations in Earth's orbit might have precipitated ice ages was published in the Philosophical Magazine in 1864 and was recognized at once as a work of the highest standard. So there was some surprise and perhaps a touch of embarrassment when it turned out that Croll was not an academic at the university, but a janitor. Born in 1821, Croll grew up poor, and his formal education lasted only to the age of 13. He worked at a variety of jobs, as a carpenter, insurance salesman, keeper of a temperance hotel, before taking a position as a janitor at Anderson's, now the University of Strathclyde, in Glasgow. By somehow inducing his brother to do much of his work, he was able to pass many quiet evenings in the university library, teaching himself physics, mechanics, astronomy, hydrostatics, and the other fashionable sciences of the day, and gradually began to produce a string of papers with a particular emphasis on the motions of Earth and their effect on climate. Croll was the first to suggest that cyclical changes in the shape of Earth's orbit, from elliptical, which is to say slightly oval, to nearly circular, to elliptical again, might explain the onset and retreat of ice ages. No one had ever thought before to consider an astronomical explanation for variations in Earth's weather. Thanks almost entirely to Croll's persuasive theory, people in Britain began to become more responsive to the notion that at some former time, parts of the Earth had been in the grip of ice. When his ingenuity and aptitude were recognized, Croll was given a job at the Geological Survey of Scotland and widely honoured. He was made a Fellow of the Royal Society in London and of the New York Academy of Science, and given an honorary degree from the University of St. Andrews, among much else. Unfortunately, just as Agassiz's theory was at last beginning to find converts in Europe, he was busy taking it into ever more exotic territory in America. He began to find evidence for glaciers practically everywhere he looked, including near the equator. Eventually, he became convinced that ice had once covered the whole Earth, extinguishing all life, which God had then recreated. None of the evidence Agassiz cited supported such a view. Nonetheless, in his adopted country, his stature grew and grew, until he was regarded as only slightly below a deity. When he died in 1873, Harvard felt it necessary to appoint 3 professors to take his place. Yet, as sometimes happens, his theories fell swiftly out of fashion. Less than a decade after his death, his successor in the chair of geology at Harvard wrote that the so-called glacial epoch, so popular a few years ago among glacial geologists, may now be rejected without hesitation. Part of the problem was that Croll's computations suggested that the most recent ice age occurred 80,000 years ago, whereas the geological evidence increasingly indicated that Earth had undergone some sort of dramatic perturbation much more recently than that. Without a plausible explanation for what might have provoked an ice age, the whole theory fell into abeyance. There it might have remained for some time, except that in the early 1900s, a Serbian academic named Milutin Milanković, who had no background in celestial motions at all, he was a mechanical engineer by training, developed an unexpected interest in the matter. Milanković realized that the problem with Croll's theory was not that it was incorrect, but that it was too simple. As Earth moves through space, it is subject not just to variations in the length and shape of its orbit, but also to rhythmic shifts in its angle of orientation to the Sun, its tilt and pitch and wobble, all affecting the length and intensity of sunlight falling on any patch of land. In particular,